Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the studio today are Michael Biedenbaugh, who's director of Preservation South Carolina, and Bill Fitzpatrick, who's a member of the board and actually vice chair of Preservation South Carolina. But he's also the author of a very recent book called Sacred Spaces. And gentlemen, both of you, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you, Walter. It's great to be here.
All right. Mike, why don't you just take a few minutes and remind our listeners what Preservation South Carolina is all about.
Preservation South Carolina is the state's only statewide nonprofit organization whose mission is to preserve, protect, and advocate for our state's endangered historic structures. We've been around since 1990. I've been fortunate enough to have actually been a member of the board in the 1990s, the late 90s, when I had my marketing company. And I came on as the opportunity showed itself to be the director in 2007, and I've been here now for the past 12 years with a wonderful group of people on the board to further the mission of saving our historic buildings.
All right. And the headquarters is where you are. You're like John Rutledge during the Revolution, right? The Capitol moves with you.
Well, we were with our gracious host of Archives and History down in Columbia for years. And we had the opportunity to save the Prosperity Depot. Now, this is something that had been really important to me personally. Growing up in Prosperity Depot was in terrible shape. And as soon as I got the card, Executive Director of Preservation South Carolina, in connections with the National Trust, we were able to exert some influence with Norfolk Southern, and we were able to get the depot, and the board was gracious enough to allow me not to have to commute 45 minutes, but 10 minutes to the depot. And so, and plus it's a wonderful poetic thing to be in a place called Prosperity.
And since you have been associated with Preservation South Carolina, gosh, now almost three decades.
Yeah.
You started when you were 10, right?
No.
So anyway, just you've got a number of successes, but again, I think our listeners need to be reminded.
Well, the thing is, one of the struggles being a statewide organization is trying to develop an organization that actually saves buildings. So we took it beyond the level of a historic society to an actual property development organization, to where we have a fund called a revolving fund, our Endangered Places Fund, and we've built the reputation of looking at these as assets, places that can attract capital. And we try to connect the value of these places, which many people see, you know, the thing in South Carolina is when you have an old house and the paint's gone, people automatically think it's not worth much. And those of us who enjoy old buildings, we still see the value. And so our job now is to connect the real value, bring that intention back into it, and elevate that to where you can attract capital to it for investment. So we get these places. And then we put them out on the marketplace. But whoever purchases the property has to have an easement on them to protect them. And so we have been, since I've been on board, we have been protecting places all over state, like Laurelwood, which is a plantation in Eastover, was one of our first projects we were able to get. We just finished doing the Weitch House, which the Weitch family in Greenville, Mr. Tommy Weitch and Brad Weitch. This was Brad Weitch's great-grandfather's home. And we had it for years because we stepped in because we were afraid it was going to be torn down. It was in Prosperity, actually. We were fortunate enough to have Brad and the family were able to come in and give us a donation to help redo all the gingerbread. It's an 1890 Queen Anne. And we were able to attract a buyer who is now renovating it right now. So that was our latest that we did as far as a house and building.
So that was in Prosperity.
That was in Prosperity. Yeah, that just happened to be in Prosperity too. And we were actually able to get it because of my connection in Prosperity. I went to school with the grandson of the current owners. And so we were able to get in that way.
But you mentioned Greenville. You had an interesting project in Greenville a few years ago with a large house.
Yes. And that year, 2015, was a fascinating year for us because we had two of our, at the time, our most important projects up to that date. And one of them was the Wilkins House in Greenville, which was Italianate Second Empire mansion that was built in 1876 on Augusta Road. and it had to be moved. It was getting ready to be destroyed. And we were able to step in and attract the resources and raise the money needed to move 800-ton brick mansion.
I was going to say it wasn't wood. It was
no, it was solid. The foundation was 3 foot thick brick walls, and able to pick that up and move it 2.5 blocks, and now it's restored and saved. And it was a wonderful success. And the same year, we also did, after moving an 800-ton mansion, we saved an 800-square-foot Gullah house that was owned by Miss Frances Jones on Defusky. So that was a good year that really shows the archetype of from one to the other.
So I'm curious, how do you move an 800-ton brick house?
Well, it involves prayer. So that's just – but the technology of moving buildings has advanced so much. And the group that did it, Wolf House Movers, did an amazing job. And basically, they were able to come in, build a platform of basically a deck. It wasn't pulled by a truck. It was pulled by – it was set on a platform, elevated up on 28 sets of tires, 4 tires each, so 4 times 28 tires, and this 800-ton thing set on this like a giant skateboard, and a guy was able to walk by it and move it with a toggle switch and moved it at 1 mile an hour down the street to its new place. And we have a film online. You can see the video of it. It's fascinating.
Bill, were you on the board then?
I was not on the board then. I was miles away from that great event in downtown Greenville.
Okay. Well, let's talk about more current projects. What does Preservation South Carolina have on the drawing board, so to speak? And Bill, I'm going to turn to you as a board member.
The focus we have as a organization right now is helping save South Carolina's sacred spaces, those churches and temples across the state that would otherwise be lost or are severely endangered. And that's my focus as an individual, and it has been the last 7 or 8 years, and it is now our focus as an organization. It's been my pleasure and great experience beginning in 2011 to have traveled the back roads of South Carolina. I've been in business a number of years, and because we sold our company in 2010, I had to sign a non-compete agreement, a 4-year non-compete agreement. Week one of that, my wife came home, looked at me, and she said, if you think you're going to sit around the house, and she said a few things I'm not going to repeat here. So I had to get out and do something, and I thought I'm going to take this opportunity to engage my interest in photography. And I looked around and thought I'd pick out some National Register landmarks that were off the beaten path, and that's where my journey began. Once I started, I couldn't stop. I ended up photographing over 1,000 landmarks across the state.
All right, 1,000 landmarks, obviously not limited to churches.
Not limited to churches, no. In fact, it became at first a personal project. I live in Greenville, and the nearest rural county that I thought that might have some opportunity was down in McCormick, Greenwood, Abbeville area. There's an historic district down there, Cedar Springs Historic District. And I decided to go down there, and this is about 8-9 years ago. I left with some maps, a cup of coffee, no GPS. The latter is very important. I got hopelessly lost, but ended up in this very historic area. Took my photographs and thought, my gosh, no one lives here anymore. This church used to have hundreds of families from the size of it. Where are these people that once worshipped here? Where did they go? Where are their homes? That trip led to another trip the following week to Spartanburg County, where I wished to have the same set of experiences. So I traveled to Shiloh Methodist Church near Inman, an old historic church built about 1811, also on the National Register, and then tried to negotiate my way over to Anderson Mill, the oldest mill in Spartanburg County. Well, it doesn't have a physical address. I'm not even sure it has GPS coordinates. I spent an hour or two trying to figure out how to go from here to there. And I got a little frustrated with it, and I thought there has to be a better way to negotiate travel among our state's National Register landmarks. So I guess I am OCD. I don't think of myself that way, but I started photographing everything in the upstate, all 430-some-odd National Register landmarks, capturing photographs and GPS coordinates to make travel easier, you know, for those who might want to take the same journey. But then I still had 3 years to go in my non-compete. I thought, well, I'll go ahead and knock out the Midlands while I'm at it and then, of course, went on to the Lowcountry. But about halfway into that journey, something else resonated with me, and these were the churches, these lonely rural outposts that make us all pause when we're on a country road. We all stop, no matter the faith or not. We all stop and look at them and wonder, and so it was with me. I went back and photographed 600 more historic churches. To find an historic church is one that's on the National Register on its own merits, one that contributes to a district, or one with an historic marker. And there's 625 of those. And I know this is a long way of getting to what I eventually ended up doing, but I ended up focusing on about 70 churches I thought were uniquely special in that I almost thought through the history of these churches, you could tell the history of South Carolina, from the Lowcountry churches to the upstate churches. I thought there's something here. And what really resonated were the people that were digging into their own pockets to help preserve the past. Some folks, and I did when I started this journey, think that being on the National Register affords certain protections. I can almost imagine a government agency up in Washington, D.C. with many stories and lots of people coming down, people with clipboards taking photographs every 6 months, and that's not the way it works. Preservation is left up to the individual.
All right, let's stop for a minute there, and that's a good point. Mike, explain what putting a building on the National Register does and does not do.
Well, putting a building on the National Register is a way for the National Park Service to recognize it as a historic structure. It puts it on a list, and that list can afford it certain benefits of tax credits, renovations, and things like that, but nothing actively is engaged by the National Register to protect a building at all.
So
the only way to protect a building is through local governance, a town, a county putting an overlay to protect it.
So if somebody bought a historic structure in Newberry County and it's on the National Register, if it's not protected by a county ordinance, they can tear it down if they want to.
Well, and that's exactly what happened to the old Matthews House, designed by Nernsey, a magnificent Queen Anne brick on the corner. The people who bought it, it was the first building put on the National Register in Newberry County, and it was the first thing these people tore down and put a drugstore in its place in 2002. So it's one of the challenges we're constantly faced with because people believe they're protected if they're on the National Register. So the sense of alarm comes usually too late when someone says they're going to demolish something. And it's part of the things we deal with every month is coming and intervening in something and trying to in our advocacy, to educate and talk about that.
Well, one of the myths about Columbia is Sherman burned everything, except as some surveys done by the late Phelps Bultmann show that between 1960 and 1980, Columbians themselves destroyed more historic structures than Sherman did in 1865.
Yeah, Sherman did a pretty good job on their torching on the main street and stuff, and didn't burn everything, but did do a lot of damage. The damage done since World War II on the state by turning property into commodity, by turning homes into houses to buy and sell, has been terribly destructive to our sense of place. And people feel victimized by it. They feel like, well, you can't stop progress. And we argue that has nothing to do with progress. Progress is when things are made more beautiful and society benefits with the aesthetic qualities of the community. That's where progress lies. And unfortunately, one of our biggest issues that we deal with is how to counter that notion that progress comes when you destroy something old. It's one of the things we're dealing with in Aiken right now with the Aiken Hospital.
What's the date on that?
The date on that, it's 1920s or 30s, I believe, off the top of my head. But it's a magnificent spot that's right at the gateway into Aiken with beautiful deodar cedars in front of it. And folks wants to turn the lot into a convention center, which is fine. But the old hospital can be repurpose as the hotel as part of the convention center. So we're engaging right now, live action, to try to do that.
All right. I'm going to be devil's advocate. Something built in the 1920s, what's important about that?
Well, it's because what's important about why is place important? Place, historic places help define us for who we are because they tell us who we were. And the investment of prior generations who come in and invest talent and skills to build something, use resources to build something, and the wastefulness, just the basic wastefulness of taking something somebody else did and just throwing it away is unsustainable. It destroys the very fabric that is the foundation of our communities. And so we're dealing with that. And that's why it's so important regarding these churches and temples, these sacred spaces. When we're sitting in the office and we get the phone call and, you know, we get many calls about, you know, somebody try to help the old house on the corner in downtown Society Hill or other towns. You know, we get a lot of those calls. But one of the fastest growing subjects that we get as far as what people call us about is the churches, is the building that their family used to go to church at. And you know, we mow the lawn or two or three people sacrifice to take care of it, but it's empty. And they're concerned. And their concern is proper because, you know, when you look at old maps, these buildings were called meeting houses. And in the early formation of our nation, this is where people met. These were the community centers where they worshiped, where they gathered, and to see these places now falling apart and disintegrating to us is almost like a canary in a coal mine. They're communicating something else about the failure of community that is concerning. And so when Bill came forward and we first met Bill several years ago and he showed us the output of his 5 years of taking pictures of all these churches, we're like, oh my goodness, this can make a difference.
Well, I just keep thinking about rural South Carolina, my own experiences driving, crisscrossing the state. Even those that are not National Register, on the National Register, you can see them at the edge of a field. Mm-hmm. You can see in what used to be a main street somewhere, and I see that's another thing that just really gets me, is the main streets of our small towns that have just disappeared.
Disappeared, yeah. I mean, I remember we had a National Trust conference in Detroit showing the economic collapse of downtown Detroit, and I'm up there talking to them saying, we've got 100 little Detroits in South Carolina. I mean, you go in downtown Maysville, in Sumter County, or Timminsville, or other little towns that are struggling because all the capital has left. The leadership, entrepreneurial leadership of 150 years ago left and went to the big urban centers, which is why some of these churches that were built with the wealth that was available 150 years ago is starting to fail. And that brings a perfect tie-in to, you know, Trinity of Abbeville. This magnificent high Gothic church put into a little town where most of the buildings were wooden and where the congregation was only 26 people. This was in 1858. The congregation, the white communicants that were paying in to support the structure was only 26 people. And this young architect named George Walker came into the community and goes, you deserve this. You deserve something that can match your aspirations. And with the leadership of the community, they built a structure that could hold 400 people when they only had a congregation of 26. Within 3 years, they had 100 people going to church. It started filling in. That's part of the story of this, is how important these places were, but also with intention putting into them, it will attract the type of resources that can help rebuild them.
I'm just thinking places, particularly across the South and the Deep South, where churches are no longer churches. They've been converted to other use, not worship space. Although there was that famous restaurant in Atlanta, the Abbey, for years.
Yeah.
So Trinity Abbeville is an active Episcopal church still.
It is an active Episcopal church, and throughout its existence, it has always been challenged by circumstances beyond the control of Abbeville. Within a few months of it being built, South Carolina seceded from the Union. And three of the primary people who helped fund the building of the church, plus the architect, did not survive the war. And so by 1920s, the place was shuttered again. The population had left until it was opened back up in the 1950s, late 40s, when it was opened back up again. So it was this big, huge, massive, high Gothic church put into a community that sometimes didn't have the resources for it. That's where it ties into South Carolina sacred spaces, because what we're now doing is the resources from the sale of that book is going into a grant system where we can now go to these places and help send resources their way to help stabilize and give them the opportunity to build their churches back again. And that means the spiritual part, the congregation as well. You know, being a historian, we all know history goes in cycles and reactions. And we see as an organization, these small sacred spaces being empty is a short-term trend. Now, short-term could be 50 years. But if we buy time and if we secure these spaces are safe and can last, we're convinced for any spiritual intention to come back, it will come back sooner if these places with tradition was still there. And that's the purpose of the Sacred Spaces Fund, so we can sit there and do that and help attract that intention to it. And Trinity is our first project.
So Preservation South Carolina is taking on to help preserve this spot in Abbeville, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. How much money you got to raise?
The overall goal of this first drive is going to be about $4 million. The church itself is looking at $2.5 to $3 million to do. We already have about $800,000 available through past donations that we're going to start on the two most vulnerable parts. One is the steeple, okay? So the steeple of this church is 125 feet tall. When it was built, when George Walker designed it, it was the tallest structure in rural South Carolina outside of Charleston and Columbia. The only thing it was shorter than in Columbia was First Presbyterian, and we have pretty good evidence George Walker designed First Presbyterian's tower. This was an important place. This is why we're putting so much focus on it, as well as other potential projects that we're looking at. One of the others is a beautiful little church built in the 1830s called Tevo, which is in Berkeley County.
Yeah, Mike, we view Trinity Episcopal as almost a one-off proposition, and just because of the cost and because of the high nature of the church, quite a few of the other churches that, and temples that we're looking at across the state are much less expensive to save. Maybe it's a tarp. Maybe it's a new roof. So we're looking at being able to impact quite a few churches at a fraction of what it might take to save Trinity Abbeville. But for those who have made the trip to Abbeville, Trinity is like no other church. To stare at it from the top of Trinity Street is not much different than you might feel if you were at the top of Wall Street and peering down that alleyway down to Trinity Wall Street. You feel the connectivity between the church and the architects and architecture in Abbeville and Wall Street. So that's a one-off, but as Mike points out, we're focused on churches and temples with small congregation, diminished congregations. I mentioned early on about Cedar Springs Historic District. That's about 4 or 5 miles from Lower Longkane Presbyterian, another beautiful historic church. That whole area was known as the Calhoun Settlement. Mm. So there in the Sumter National Forest, you have a couple churches and so much history worthy of being saved. A year or so ago, I came across the fact that the earliest American ancestors of William Randolph Hearst are buried at Cedar Spring.
Oh.
Fascinating history. Congregation at Cedar Springs is down to about 20, I believe. At Lower Longkane, 5.
Ooh.
And they're in charge of this historic structure that dates to 1850.
So when you've got a congregation that small, I mean, literally, it's just a few folks, as you said, mowing the lawn, mm-hmm. keeping it up the best way they can.
It is. And I think the most important thing to remember when we're looking at trying to invest and save these places is, like, you know, $5,000 will buy some of these places 20 years. You know, just making sure a couple pieces of tin are nailed down, do a termite treatment. And the population trend, as empty as the areas are around here, is absolutely positive. More people will come back. And we're just trying to buy time for these things. And I think one of the reasons we're focused on Trinity, one, because of the opportunity, we're working directly with the diocese. Preservation South Carolina has a 5-year exclusive lease on the structure. The congregation is worshiping in the parish house behind the church, and we have the keys, and we are now engaged in getting contractors to do the work it's going to take to save it. And we're confident we can pull that off because the story of Trinity is one of national significance. Bill made reference to the Wall Street image. I am convinced because of the connectivity with Upjohn, who designed Trinity Wall Street, and the personal relationship he had with E.B. White, who designed the Huguenot Church and was one of our state's leading architects.
And Trinity Columbia.
And Trinity Columbia and Grace Episcopal.
In Charleston.
In Charleston. In fact, after E.B. White visited Upjohn and saw the building of Trinity in the 1840s, the first structure he came down to do was the Huguenot Church, which was pretty close to being one of our first high Gothic churches that was designed in the state. And E.B. White joined the New York Ecclesiological Society. And this is a fascinating group of people that Upjohn was one of the founding members of. And its theory was that the Christian Society of America needed Gothic architecture to uplift it, to be its own indigenous architecture, and none of this classical stuff out of Greece. In fact, Pugin, one of the inspirations for forming the group, made clear that what was made in Italy should stay in Italy, and only the spires and the belfries of Gothic is a true Christian architecture. So it was an intentional thing. Now, Gothic architecture is somewhat ubiquitous with churches. You tend to see it everywhere. But in 1840, it didn't exist. And these people made a concerted effort to do it. And so we're pretty convinced that when Walker went into this little village of Abbeville to convince them to build this church, there is an amazing print of 1850 showing Trinity and Wall Street at the head. And I am convinced he showed them this and said, "This is what you deserve." And that's what inspired him to build it.
All right. Gentlemen, need to pause for a moment, let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Mike Biedenbaugh and Bill Fitzpatrick from Preservation South Carolina about the group's activities here in 2019. All right. The spire of Trinity, Abbeville. Yes. That made me start thinking. That is the tallest structure in Abbeville, is it not?
It's the tallest church spire in rural South Carolina.
But I'm thinking
the
landscape of Abbeville. You see it everywhere.
Everywhere.
And I'm just thinking about when Notre Dame burned in Paris.
Yes.
And the spire collapsed. The front towers were important, still there, but that spire, that Gothic spire, which was put in as part of the Gothic revival, people don't realize it was not original,
right?
But the spire meant such a great deal to, you know, the skyline.
Yeah.
And so this really is the focal point of the skyline of the town of Abbeville.
We talk about it in the community. This is the combination of the Mona Lisa and the Eiffel Tower for Abbeville. The artistic element of what it is, the poetry that it communicates, and just. Again, it's about the aspiration of these people who built, and it reflects in people who see it in their own sense of aspiration. That's why it's so important. So we stepped in when it was reported in a study done 5 years ago that it was actually starting to lean, and water intrusion into the base. It's all timber frame with 40-foot tall 12 by 12 timbers. It's just a magnificently built piece, engineering. What Walker and Johnson did in engineering is magnificent. But the foundational pieces within the masonry wall are starting to rot and collapse. So it's leaning over 15 inches.
Ooh, that's a fair amount.
Yes.
The whole building?
No, just spire.
The
wooden spire. So imagine a masonry Gothic base, and then the wooden spire comes out of that.
Oh, okay.
And the wooden spire is 2/3 of the height of the front of the church. It sticks up that, it raises that high. And so that's what prompted the diocese to shutter the church and close it because of the potential danger of that. And we came in with some solutions that we thought would work. And so now we have the keys to the place and working with timber framers from Michigan who came down to do study on it. We're working with James Metters and Metters Inc. to do the analysis and do the construction management of it. So we brought in the big guns to make this thing work.
So you're starting with the spire.
Starting with the spire.
Masonry structures, and this has stucco on top of
the. Well, and here's the big issue was in the 1970s, the community and the congregation thought the outside of the church looked old and needed to be redone. And of course, they were some folks were convinced that a guy showed up with Portland cement and they restuccoed it with Portland cement and covered it with something that is now damaging the exterior walls. So all that has to be removed and restuccoed.
But Mike, in the 1960s, that was something that preservationists recommended.
Oh, I know.
I'm just telling you.
Oh, I know. Well, I'm not. You know, the thing is, short-term trends, you know, we have to be watchful. And so with that experience, when we're looking at ways to redo buildings, we always have to be conscious of where were the mistakes done in the past that seemed right at the time. But what is the truth in restoring this place? And it always boils down to one thing. How was it built before? What worked when it was built? And the old lime-based rough cast exterior is all it needs. And the timber that built this timber frame building, the engineering of it is magnificent. That's all it needs. And so we just have to return to those basics in redoing it. And that's our commitment to this structure is to do that.
Actually, I think it was Bill that mentioned termite protection for rural structures. Now, they might have been built out of heart pine originally, but even that over time will decay, right?
Well, it will. I mean, water in South Carolina, water is the enemy. The other big enemy since World War II has been underpinning. I mean, the belief that you've got to make underneath these buildings sealed up and dark has been why it's been such a proliferation of termite damage, because that darkness, along with a little bit of a leak, is where the termites come from. If the places were open, it will diminish the ability of termites to make a home. So again, you have to go back to the traditional methods and empower those is the best way to maintain these places.
Mike, if I could add a thought to this, that's true. But I think what really struck me as I traveled across the state is if a structure is not in a major South Carolina city, and there's only a handful of those, if it is in Lower Long Cane, if it's up in Cherokee County, if it's in near Sharaw, the place is at risk through just indifference. We have the rich cities, and then we have the other cities in South Carolina. And so I think until there's an awareness that these places are at risk, whether it be from water damage or termite damage, it starts there perhaps, but we have to be aware that if we don't step in as a people, as an organization or as a group of citizens to contribute to preserving this history, it will be lost. And if you'll allow me, I'll give you one example. I was up this past weekend. I traveled to Cherokee County to visit Mulberry Methodist Church, a place I've been to four or five times over the past 7 or 8 years. It's on the National Register. It's called a Black Reconstruction Era church. That's not quite accurate. It was built, I think, about 1880, but close enough. And that care, that beautiful Gothic structure that is about 10 miles from Pacolet, is now at risk. It's leaning. There's one or two people now responsible for taking care of it. That's not enough. Is that place important? Should it be saved? We need to at least ask the questions. And I could repeat that same set of questions for many other places across the state, as Mike and I have done. Our mind always snaps back to Trinity, Abbeville, and the great work that needs to be done there because it does center the city, because it is the first thing people see when they come into the square. And we're going to make this happen with support from people across the state. But there are places other than that, too, that we need to focus attention and buy that roof and help a five-member congregation save what should not be lost.
Yeah, I think it's important. It's with Trinity and all of these, and when Bill was talking about the churches of the big cities, and you cannot look at Grace Episcopal Cathedral in Charleston and not know there is Trinity is its first cousin. The you know, when E.B. White built Grace, Walker was there building it. And I'm convinced the spire is so tall at Trinity of Abbeville because Walker and E.B. White wasn't able to build their tall spire on Grace like they had wanted to before the city pulled out funding. There's a lot of old interconnectivity with all of these places that when you save these rural churches, there's a part of it where you're able to save your own, because as the tide rises for some, it'll rise for all of them. And that's what everybody has to remember with these places.
Well, you talk about, you mentioned Episcopal churches, Methodist churches. What role are the denominations playing in any of this? I mean, for years, for example, until the late 20th century, the Methodist Conference helped support rural congregations. Mm-hmm. Then they stopped doing that, financial reasons. Other denominations, every congregation's independent. You mentioned that the Episcopal Diocese of Upper South Carolina had cooperated with you on the Trinity Abbeville, but you know, who really has control of some of these properties?
It's different with everyone. You know, every denomination has a different set of standards and rules on how church property is governed. What we have found is many of these denominations are challenged by the diminishing group of people that are coming to traditional churches. So what we've been getting the feedback is, we will help you in whatever way we can, in the sense of giving y'all the ability to come in and help do it. You know, thank goodness Bishop Waldo did what he did and signed the papers for us to do this. We could not be doing this without the support of the Upper Diocese of the Episcopal Church. We've been talking with other denominations at the same time of trying to figure out. It's a challenge. It's a challenge.
Well, you know, I know some of them are interested, but I think of rural Lexington County, where even in the 1960s, there were three little churches as part of one charge. Mm-hmm. They used to support their own clergy. Now it's shared at best. All the congregations are dwindling. And certainly one case, and I won't mention the name, the major financial supporters no longer are with us.
It is a challenge on the individual church basis, but we're standing back and looking at the bigger picture of what do we want our society to look like 100 years from now. I mean, preservation is not as much about just trying to preserve buildings of the past as it is trying to protect them for folks that we don't know yet. How will we communicate what South Carolina's history looks like to people that aren't here yet? Our mission is empowered with the fact that we believe if we hold on to these places, future generations will be able to learn and utilize them. And I'm convinced that intention will come back to them if we hold on to them and buy them time.
I think so too, Mike. The one of the counties that captured my imagination was Sumter County, mm-hmm. A county that in 1860, I believe, is one of the richest per capita.
Sumter was the richest per capita county, which drives people in Georgetown and Charleston crazy, but it's the truth.
Well, I picked a fine time to tell the truth, which pleases me. So it was the richest county in 1860 per capita. Mm-hmm. Basis. And I looked at the population statistics in 1950. I'm going to say roughly 60,000 people lived in the county. I might be off by a few thousand, but today there's double that amount. So when I think of that, I think to Mike's point, there are more people, more intention, more appreciation for what's happened in the past. And I think of those three churches in Sumter County that I came to love, Church of the Holy Cross, that nearly was lost 20 years ago through termite damage, a beautiful church, much in the style of Trinity Abbeville. High Hills of the Santee.
Yep, Pise de Terre.
That's right. And Mike knows what that means.
Yes.
Yes.
Pounded earth.
Pounded earth, and it's a remarkable structure and very unique in this country. So we had that that landmark, and then High Hills of the Santee, the Furman Church. And then 15 miles down the road, St. Mark's, I think, was a parish congregation back before the war. So when you look at the increase in population, increased wealth, and hopefully that brings the increased intention to Mike's point.
You talked about a county where the population is growing. We've got counties where the population is declining. Mm-hmm. In fact, today Allendale County doesn't have the population. If it were to apply to be a county, it doesn't meet the constitutional requirements for being a county. Yeah. It's smaller than 10,000 people. If you look at the I-95 corridor, Williamsburg County, those beautiful churches and small main streets, the old country store.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Timmonsville. The whole PD with the collapse of tobacco and the tobacco warehouses, which provided an economic basis for those communities. It's hard.
It is. But the thing, again, that history informs us is in these times of transition, which we are in a time of economic transition now, what were the things that built our communities and what will build the future communities? And you see it, and as much as people want to make jokes about young people and millennials, I tell you, I see the energy and compassion from this, from these younger folks to see what does this place mean. You see that in the discussions and conversations. So we have optimistic hope that these trends that have been happening that are shifting from old traditional patterns of economic development will change and be accommodated for attracting it again. And as we sit here and look at how our organization and the Sacred Spaces Fund is going to give grants to churches when we decide when we do that, we will take into account what groups will have sustainable models to utilize whatever grant they get for the building. It won't be about just giving money to buildings that put a roof on if it's going to sit there empty for 20 years. It's about what else does this mean. So one of the things we're most excited about is because we're able to build a sustainable plan that we believe is sustainable for the future of the church, we've been awarded a $250,000 grant from Fund for Sacred Places to go to Trinity. It's going to require a match, and we're going to be working on that. But
where is the grant from?
From Philadelphia. It was the National Fund for Sacred Places. And out of 246 applications, our organization in Trinity was one of only 9 recipients, and we got one of the largest things. So,
wow. Yeah. So that's going to start with the spire, right?
Well, that actually was – we actually have the funds to work on the spire, and we're working on the plans for that now. That is going to be focused on the stucco and all the challenges to redo the exterior and put the rough cast in place.
Okay. All right. I want to get back to the PD.
Allendale County, you know, when I look at a county and I think what resources do they have to attract businesses, intention – opportunity to the local residents. I go back to historic landmarks, a sense of self, a sense of message, who we are, this is what we stand for. And whether it's a tobacco barn or whether it's an historic church that's been preserved, I think those are the things that would make a difference. Those are the things that would attract businesses. In Allendale County, there are 2 terrific rural churches in the National Register. One is Smyrna Baptist Church. And the other, let's see, I've forgotten its name, but they had a schism at the Baptist Church. And we've been in contact with that group, and it wouldn't take much for provide the funds for maybe for a new tin roof to help them save these churches, maybe repurpose them as a wedding destination, a museum. Those are the things that we're looking at, not just a building, but what can we do to make it a viable enterprise.
All right. That's an interesting point, talking about repurposing and a business plan. Do you all have models that you can present to folks, or?
Well, it depends on where they are. So Trinity, we see Trinity during our next 5 years of the lease. You know, we see it as a wedding event space for recitals, has wonderful acoustics, with its great John Baker Tracker organ, one of the only 2 left remaining in the world.
Well, I was going to ask about that. I have looked at the video that you have on your website, and the organ attracted me. I mean, that's – what kind of shape is it in?
Well, it's all there in pieces. All the pieces are accounted for. It was taken apart by a repair person that did not do the job he was supposed to do. And so we're going to have it rebuilt. But John Baker, a Charlestonian, came up, used to work for Urban. He lived in Charleston, but he came from England, then through New York, worked for Urban, who put in the organ at Trinity in Wall Street. And then Baker came down here to Charleston, put in the organ for Urban in the Huguenot Church. And John Baker set up his own shop and started making organs and put in an organ in Grace, Episcopal, what is now Grace Episcopal Cathedral, and then he put in the organ in Trinity, in Abbeville. And there's only two of his organs left, one in Trinity and the other one in Edgefield, St. Mary's in Edgefield. But talking to the point of sustainability, so it's according to where they are, right? And so Trinity has its own way we can try to figure out how to attract capital and cash flow to that. But the other one is there's a church, Good Hope Baptist Church, out on Sumter Highway, out near Hopkins, right on the road. They're trying to figure out what to do. Well, here's a building that has 8,000 to 10,000 cars going by it every day. So there could be an economic use of that to hold on, to give reason for the structure to be there, to sustain it, until a congregation can come back a generation or two later, which is how we view that.
So there's no congregation in there now?
The conference is looking at what they need to do with the building, and we're in talks with them now about that one. Our first goal is always what congregation can come back in and put intention into it. Then, if it's not there, how do we build a cash flow model to keep it standing until one can? And that's how we view the lens through all the churches that we look at.
Okay. All right. I want to focus a little bit now on Bill and his book, Sacred Spaces. How many churches were in your publication?
The final count was roughly 70 sacred spaces, of which probably 66 were churches, and I had a few temples in there as well. So a total of 70 of South Carolina sacred spaces. And they're a mixture of parish churches along the coast. Not so much, I didn't focus so much on the downtown churches, but those rural churches that are in the less traveled cities. And then in the middle part of the state, obviously, there was some Lutheran immigrations that came in the mid-1700s. And then the upstate very much got the feel of the Scots-Irish coming down and settling the upper part of the state. So that mixture. And then when I you combine those settlements with the African American history that's available to us, religious history, through the from praise houses along the coast. Mother Emanuel's well known, but I mentioned earlier Mulberry Methodist up in Cherokee County. Collectively, that's a church history, maybe even overall history, that's probably pretty unique in the country.
Bill, I'm going to put you on the spot. What is your favorite church?
Are we still recording?
We're still recording.
How about
giving me your favorite three and why you select those three?
The first one would be Lower Long Cane Presbyterian. I mentioned that earlier, and that truly is in a forgotten part of the state. In truth, you get to Abbeville, you take a 20-minute drive from downtown Abbeville, and you are in the middle of nowhere. And I felt that the overall South Carolina arc of history there, and this is where the folks came down the Appalachians and settled. It was the Calhouns that settled there. The Hearst family settled there, people hoping to make a living. In the early 1800s, people from Charleston, the planters from Charleston, arrived and had great expectations to make money on short supply cotton. And then to sit there at this church, the Lower Long Cane Presbyterian Church.
And what does it look like? Briefly describe it.
It would be, Mike is probably better at these than I am.
It's pure Greek Revival. It's a Greek Revival temple with massive Greek Doric columns on the front and a wood frame box, basically.
Okay. And it sits in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing around Lower Long Cane Presbyterian. It's backwards now. The road used to run in front of it. It doesn't anymore. The road is in the back of the church, which is unique and unsettling at the same time. But here's a history. In the graveyard near the church, there's ancestors that go back to 1740, 1750. And you stand in awe thinking there were hundreds of families that once worshipped here. And if you meet, say, John Greer, who speaks for the church, and realize he's the last of a generation, last of a line of people that will take care of this church. And when he tells you, after I'm gone, I'm not sure what's going to happen here, okay. I feel the history. Okay. I feel that history up in Cherokee County. I mentioned Mulberry Methodist. When I met with Moose Littlejohn, a black gentleman who takes care of the church to the best of his ability, which means cutting the grass, maybe replacing a board here and there. And he does that in his spare time with money out of his own pocket. And the last time I saw him was a couple of years ago. His 90-year-old dad helped him. This church is on the National Register. It's not going to survive many more years. He was so proud of the fact that I remember my last conversation with Moose was the fact that he was able to scrape up enough money, get some contributions, took him 3, 4, 5 years, but he got an historic marker. He said, I got an historic marker in front of this church. And he was very proud of that. I imagined that spot 10 years from now, and all that's left will be the historic marker.
And, you know, that is one of the sad things about historic markers. On this site was...
I know. Well, the historic markers and murals on walls. I mean, towns love to tear down a building and then they memorialize it by painting it on a wall of another building downtown. And so, you know, we're here to try to remind that the buildings tell the story, and we need to keep them alive to keep doing that to inform us.
All right. Well, Mike, those words I think are a pretty good one to end our conversation today, and I want to thank Bill Fitzpatrick and Mike Biedenbaugh, both from Preservation South Carolina, for being with us today on The Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. What Bill Fitzpatrick and Mike Biedenbaugh and Preservation South Carolina are trying to do in the 21st century is help to preserve the texture and the spirit of rural South Carolina. Whether it's the Lone Canes Presbyterian Church or Trinity Episcopal Church in Abbeville, these buildings reflect generations of communities which are beginning to disappear. And as both men said during our conversation, they're not preserving for preservation's sake. They're preserving for future generations with the hope that younger South Carolinians will appreciate the past and incorporate these structures into our state's future. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.